see that, wait, I'm going to change my display here. Because you can read this a lot better than you can read the white on black up there on that screen.
Oh, that makes it a little bit more difficult.
Yeah, I thought it was.
There's a zoom protractor in there.
Yeah, okay, there we go.
We'll get to it.
Okay.
50%
faster. What is?
Firefox.
Mr. Technology over there, something to say.
Hey, Lee, get that door, please.
Okay, there's two paper topics for due Monday at 11:59 p.m. Last time I tried to say 12 midnight. I tried in every way I could to make it explicit what I meant, but somebody thought it meant 12 midnight the day before. So this time it's Monday, 11:59 p.m. The paper is due in my inbox.
How many seconds?
59.
And 59. Yes, I should have put to have it that detailed because Oak will register when it comes in to the second. So.
Wow.
To what time? To the official world clock time?
I'm just going to be sitting there.
So
this is not law school.
So we've got two paper topics here. And I will be, I'm going to refine the wording of the first one. I wanted you to focus on this, on Amaret and Scudamore. To think about question of desire as portrayed around those two characters. Construct an argument about what you think Spencer means to say about desire. And I'm going to cut this phrase in these pages because I don't exactly mean that you draw your evidence solely from Canto 6 or 11. What I mean is that you analyze the character of Amaret and Scudamore in relation to Spencer's ideas about desire. And basically, I could have taken any pair in the poem and say, you know, this entire canto, this entire book three is about desire and chastity. Use these two characters to think about Spencer's, what you think Spencer's views of that topic are, views are. I think it was Amir, somebody was pointing out before class that they didn't see a lot of specific stuff about desire in Canto 11. Concerning those characters. Well, that may or may not be the case in your reading, but you've seen countless passages with various portrayals about desire. And Canto 6 with the Garden of Adonis and Venus's home is, you know, gives you all kinds of material for thinking about Spencer's thoughts about sexual desire. And Canto 11 gives you an image of a man, Scudamore, that you can analyze. So that's my intention in picking them. Does that clarify the nature of the topic? It's a I say, make your case analyzing Spencer's use of imagery, parallelism, and contrasting characters and episodes. So I want you to be sure that in the course of your paper, you prove your point. Whatever you say Spencer thinks about sexual desire, you prove it by analyzing imagery, parallel motifs, and contrasting characters or episodes. All three of those forms of analysis have to be in there. Now this...
Parallelism in terms of, like, word structure?
Pardon me?
Isn't parallelism...
Parallelism can be from word structure to...
Like an illusion he makes?
Yes,
I mean... With the, like, pair, like, is that the same thing kind of as comparing contrasting characters?
We will be looking today at a obvious parallel from book 1 and book 12. Okay, Rittermart is wounded in both scenes.
So within the story.
That's a parallel. I don't want to say it, I don't want to define it too narrowly, because one could essentially say everything in the poem has some kind of parallel version of itself somewhere else, or a double of itself somewhere else, from the simplest words and lines to the most complex episodes. They occur over and over again in parallel variation.
Jesus.
And everything has contrasting versions of itself. So every version of innocence has versions of guilt that are contrasted with it. These are such major motifs. I mean, such major techniques that Spencer uses to write his poem that I don't want to circumscribe your choice too narrowly. And imagery could be, you know, repeated motif, repeated image. It could be an epic simile that has got some particular meaning. Could be just a very striking image that reveals something about one of these characters. This is a very, both of these I hope are fairly advanced topics. This is, topic one is the kind of thing you'd get in a upper level literature course, which you're eligible to take. Some first year students take upper level English classes. And this is the kind of more advanced, complex topics that you will be forced to deal with when you get into your major, whatever it is. This is an English major version, but in a history or whatever, you'll have topics that require you to think for yourself and do several operations at once, not just one. Does that make sense to you as to why I made this? Design this topic in a fairly challenging way? You've got a question?
No.
Now the other one, remediate, compare the journey to Weathertop in the book and in the game of Lotra. Has everyone read that topic previously? Or do you have questions about that? We probably need to organize an expedition or two to the top of Weathertop. Perhaps somebody can get on Facebook and arrange times. Matt Shelton is raising his hand. And Matt Shelton is raising his hand. When would you be able to take people up there? Tonight would be one. Now, to get to complete the Weathertop quest, you have to do a bunch of preliminary quests. It's a chain, so you need to allow time. And those of you that how many have a character that's under level 20 right now? This will be challenging for you. Well, so you're going to need to have a high-level person help you, or you will fail. You will die a horrible death repeatedly without the assistance of somebody higher than the 20s, because a 20 won't be able to protect you. You'll need a 40-ish person, 30 or 40-ish, to protect you. I mean, 20s could do this easily.
As a group.
As a group. It is a six-person group quest. The one, Matt Shelton, and you could do it together. But it is a six-person quest for people in the 20s. And even to get to Weathertop, if you're not in your 20s, you're going to need somebody to escort you, killing everything in your path. So do you have any friends in this class that are higher than level 20? Do you want to make friends quickly?
Now's the time to take bribes, Jim.
with people like Matt Shelton over there, or Jim, or Kyle, or even Matt Hall and Jay Clayton. And so what about Sunday? I mean, Saturday's the football game. What about and Saturday morning? I'll be up early. Anybody want to get up at, say,
6 a.m.?
I was going for 5 a.m. I can't get up at 3:30.
Stay up till.
He could stay up till 3:30. I can't stay up till 3:30.
3:30.
But I can get up at 5.
No, sir.
Okay, so how many would like to do? What time does the game start?
4.
Oh.
Well, 4 is when we have to be there.
4 is when the band leaves.
Oh, so we could do it Saturday midday, right? We could do it Saturday at.
I have a lesson at 10.
It might be like a 7 o'clock.
We could do it like.
How many people would like to? How many people would like to go Saturday at midday, like 1 or 1 o'clock, 1 or 2? How many would like to go Sunday?
We're just going
to
do the Spencer essay.
1 or 2. What?
Spencer essay.
You're going to fail.
Good.
You're epic fail. Fail. Not that I'm prejudging you.
Evan's such a fragile self-esteem.
I thought I would make it so, choice one, so hard.
No one but the dedicated
English major would dare, dare to step onto that turf.
I have a good class.
Do we have English majors in here?
Yeah. I was an English major.
Really?
Are any of us English?
I would hope so.
I've been to England.
I speak English.
Okay, maybe I'll just delete topic one.
I'll write your topic.
This remediating weather top is the coolest topic ever invented.
We've written like 18 years,
on a quest to the top.
Okay.
You're
the professor.
I'm going for Weathertop. Well, come on, let's do Weathertop before we decide.
Yeah, do Weathertop.
Do not delete topic one.
What? Do not delete topic one.
Agreed, man.
Okay.
Democracy in action. You won't be
pleading and begging.
Okay.
I think it might be worse.
So. Let's move on to Spencer. So today we had Canto 11 and 12 to discuss. Who had summaries of what went on? Who had access to summaries of what went on in the intervening cantos, 7, 8, 9, and 10. Did everyone read a summary of what went on intervening? So you saw that there was a lot more pairs of lovers running around, getting chased, getting into misadventures that just the few that we've been able to study in this class. And I feel like that's important to your kind of grasp of what romance is like, because when the experience of reading the whole book is one of just complex intertwining of multiple stories. And you can see that a little bit in Tolkien when, in the later books of The Fellowship of the Ring, you'll be following Frodo and Sam, and then it'll shift away to another part of the Fellowship and tell their stories. And that's a little bit of the effect that Spencer's achieves in this book. And that it is a feature of the genre, the romance genre, one that Tolkien didn't, you know, make up, but learn from his reading. But Canto 11 is where Britomir finds Scudamore. I don't want to talk about him that much, because I want you all to be able to analyze his character without us having done the work previously. So let's not talk about our impressions of Scudamore that she finds. But instead, I did want to draw your attention to stanza 3 in Canto 11, where she encounters a giant. A giant who is is the brother of another giant that you called Argante, that you didn't meet. It was in one of the cantos that you all skipped. And what is that giant doing?
Chasing
what?
Spire of Danes.
What?
Spire of Danes.
And who is the Squire of Danes, as far as you can tell? Yeah, he actually appears in the intervening chapters, but cantos. But some guy.
Is he like really promiscuous knight?
Promiscuous.
Look at 3. Who with Sir Satyrane, as erst ye read, forth riding from Melbeco's hostless house, far off espied a young man, the which fled from a huge giant that with hideous and hateful outrage long him chased thus. It was that Oliphant, the brother dear of that Argante, vile and vicious, from whom the Squire of Dames was reft by Lear. This all is bad as she, and worse if worse aught were. For as the sister did in feminine and filthy lust exceed all womankind, so he surpassed his sex masculine in beastly use that I did ever find. Whom, when has Britomart beheld him behind the fearful boy so greedily pursue, she was unmoved in her noble mind to employ her puissance to his rescue, and pricked fiercely forth where she him did view. So it's a young man being chased by the giant. Why is the giant chasing her? As far as you can tell from these two stanzas.
I think she wants to get revenge on him.
She?
Isn't the giant that's chasing him?
Oliphant's chasing him. Why is she chasing him? Why did you think when you thought she was a she, why did you think she was chasing him?
I thought she was trying to get with the Squire of Danes.
Sexually.
Yeah.
Correct. Now change the gender. That giant's out to rape that boy. So, you know, when I say forms of desire being throughout this book, like giving you an example in Canto 11 of, you know, the word in beastly use, bestiality, or sodomy, has always and still to this day means both bestiality and sex from behind. And it did in Spencer's day as well. And so, you know, Spencer is very frank about these forms of sexual desire. And I think I was prompted to focus on this by a comment that they didn't see any forms of desire in here. But it's not just Scudamore that you should be looking at. Yes, Derek.
Is the thing about Oliphant and Argante about... I had to read the whole thing because I didn't have things. This might not make sense to some people. But it said that Argante was one of the giants that sinned against all things natural.
Yes. He was a very unnatural giant.
It's the same thing with Oliphant.
Yeah. One of the giants that sinned against all... And giants were a kind of symbol often of sinning against all natural things, so that their unnatural size and character was a kind of embodiment of their spiritual condition, which is sinning against everything that's natural. Let's skip over all this stuff about Scudamore come to, other than to say that Britomart meets up with him, hears that Amoret has been taken away by an evil magician named what? Boussarang. Been taken away by an evil magician, and Britomart just steps right forward and says, no problem, I'm on the case. I'll go after Boussarang, get Amoret back. And she goes to Boussarang's castle. What does she find at Boussarang's castle?
The Wall of Flames.
Wall of Flames, where?
Bar
in the door.
Didn't Scudamore say there was supposed to be like a wall of guards as well, doing a guard's prison?
Why not?
I have no idea.
Keep that question in mind, so that maybe you'll figure it out. Door of fire, but just tell us what happens, so I don't have to do all the talking.
Britomart puts her shield in front of her and walks through the flames. Then when Scudamore tries it, he gets burned and has to wait outside while she goes on.
Right. Why do you think?
Because Boussarang doesn't want guys to come into the castle.
Interesting. We had two different interpretations. She's pure, he wasn't. You said Boussarang doesn't want males. Yeah.
Was he like rushed in and she wouldn't come?
Yeah, I think that's a third one. I think that and in stanza 26 we get more evidence of this. Whom, when, as Scudamore saw, if you can find it that way, everybody there. Whom, when, as Scudamore saw past the fire, safe and untouched, he likewise gan assay with greedy will and envious desire. This is more Sam's point here, that it was his attitude, is how he did it. So we got three different interpretations. I'm not going to decide among them. I think that those are all interesting ways to view it. It might be that Boussarang didn't want any male competition or any knights, either one, getting in there. Or it may be that she's purer, more chaste. Certainly she's the flower of chastity, to use the phrase Spencer uses about her. Or Sam's, drawn on this stanza, said, he just had the wrong attitude. He was too boastful, too greedy, envious, threatful pride, so he couldn't get through. It's a common romance motif, the fire that'll let the virtuous person through, the others not. You've seen it, probably in a video game. and you've also seen giants in video games. And you've let me say that in Canto 11 and 12, be taking notes of landscape features, of characters, because I think that one of the things we're going to do is build Busarin's castle and maybe some of the characters in it, some of the giants. So just be alert and be thinking of who, you know, which character you would like to construct as well. So once they get in the door, what do they encounter? What's the most, the longest passage in the entire canto is about it. How's it decorated?
More tapestries.
Say that with gusto in your
more
voice.
More tapestry.
More tapestry. Hallelujah. What's it a tapestry of?
It starts out being, in the first room, I think they were all about stories of love, and then it sort of progresses to the violence of war that love causes as she goes deeper into the castle.
Very nice. Very nice. Deep reading. It goes from stanza 29 all the way through stanza 46. So the entire body of this canto is an example of what do we call poetry about pain? We should have... If we were having a final exam, this would so be on it. Exactly, ekphrasis. The entire heart of this canto is an example of ekphrasis, poetry about a painting, or about art. In this case, tapestry. And you've given us a kind of thematic reading of what the canto's, the tapestry's about, and it's absolutely spot on. Well, how else would you describe the canto of the tapestries? Just in terms of subject matter. Who do they most concern?
Still like Greek myths.
A lot of Greek myths.
Yeah.
A lot of the pictures I showed you of Jupiter raping women are brought up specifically in these passages as a good prep for reading this. Who's the main character in this tapestry? Pardon me?
Which one are we looking at?
Which one? Tapestry series.
Would it be Joe?
I don't think it would be.
Maybe a Cupid? Because it's constantly talking about what Cupid is doing.
Cupid is the hero of this tapestry. This is tapestries devoted to Cupid's depredations among the gods and the mortals. Cupid's axe. So another way of thinking about the topic of desire, maybe I should change this to a paper topic about to being about Cupid himself. I'm going to do that. I may add a Cupid topic if not leaving this. It's about Cupid. Now, let's, and then...
Can't that just be factored into that topic?
It could be.
Just desire.
I would think that if I'm asking you to think about how desire is portrayed in Canto 11, you would have to be thinking a lot about the acts of Cupid as displayed in this ekphrastic passage on the ekphrastic heart of the stanza. So what all does Cupid up to?
Actually, it starts out with these with Io. And I don't know.
It does start out with Jove. Somebody who said Jove, you know, was you know, stanzas 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35 were all about what Cupid made Job do. That's a good excuse for Job's desire. Cupid made me do it. And then, 36, we got fair Phoebus. Who's Phoebus?
Apollo.
Phoebus Apollo, god of, in this case, the sun, but also of medicine and of poetry. What? Music, lyre, exactly. It had multi uses. And his love of Hyacinth, and then that's devoted to Phoebus, 36, 37, 38, 39. Who comes up in 40?
Neptune.
Neptune, god of the sea, obviously. And over on 43, Saturn, and on 44, Mars. What's the story of Mars and Venus?
They're married.
Are they
lovers?
Aren't they?
Like Venus cheated on her.
Her husband. Who was her husband? Hephaestus. Exactly. Take a look up there. Famous painting of. Can you dim us down? It's number two, say, on lights, if you're able to get it to work. Lights.
I'm hitting lights. It's over the evening.
Hit scene two.
It's on scene two right now.
Oh, okay. Hit five. I have to experiment around and figure out which one dims it. There you go. This is Hephaestus, who has been told that his wife Venus is cheating on him. And over there is Cupid. And down here, very dim. Is six better? Is that right? Try six. Hit six. Yeah, you can't see it.
You might want to zoom in, Jay. Lower right-hand corner where that 100%
I'm
is.
Clicking on it.
No, go down to the right, the new browser. There you go.
Ah, okay. Oh, perfect. Well, no. Can you see better now? Little face right there under the... under the.
Yeah, you see that head popping out of the
Couch, whatever that is. So that's Mars hiding. And take a look at Cupid. What does he look like there?
Chilling.
What?
Chilling
is definitely what he's doing. He's sound asleep. Anything more about him? Is that what? Well, he always looks like a young winged cherubim kind of. What? He almost does look like he's in a cradle, doesn't he? How else? Any more?
He's enjoying it.
He is enjoying it. What is it? Does it look like?
I was enjoying it if you just sound asleep.
What has just been going on in the room prior to Vulcan bursting in? Lots of lovemaking. Most people read him as being exhausted after lovemaking. But he is the son, the child of Venus. So that would be awfully kinky.
I just looked up Cupid.
Yes.
And there were either two Cupids or two sides to the figure Cupid.
Well,
and one was the son of Jupiter and Venus. And he, plays pranks and spreads love. While the other is the son of Nyx and Erebus. And is known for Rida's debauchery. So
right now you've got two sides of Cupid, both of which are on display in this at Phrasis. Thank you for that, Lee. Both of them are on display. The prankish, impish, spreading mayhem just for the fun of spreading mayhem, and the debauched little roué. He looks like he's in a post-coital exhaustion there. And as you will see, and so Lee's saying that, yeah, well, he doesn't have to be having sex with his mother. It could be the other Cupid that's born of who?
Nyx and Erebus.
Nyx and Erebus, I've never even heard of them. But,
well, Nyx is goddess of night.
I mean, Juno is Jupiter's wife, so, I mean, Juno is his sister, so, I mean, it's not like they... It's not like
incest is...
Right. Have occurred.
There is that point as well. There is that point as well.
It was okay.
But there's also a kind of metaphoric point that Cupid takes so much pleasure in just, you know, in sexual desire that he's just satiated afterwards, even if he wasn't involved. And what another way to put it, and that's a lot of reading on that one little sleeping Cupid. So let's look at some more depictions of him to see how often he seems to be, you know, there he is with Venus again. And, you know, there's a lot of motifs of amorousness there. There's those birds down there, doves kissing was always a sign of amorous love. And he looks quite enraptured with Venus. I'm just kind of going at random through pictures of there's Venus feeding Cupid milk. Sorry, that's not very useful. There's the Bronzino. Oh, and it's forbidden for me to see the Bronzino full size. What I'm driving at is that in the Renaissance, Venus, Cupid was often seen as not just shooting other people and making them get amorous, but as fully so reveling in amorous desire that he was a symbol of it, not just the cause of it. That's a way to put it. Would you bring our lights back up? I guess it was two we've discovered that gives us full light. So, how many times have we seen Cupid and Venus and Adonis motifs in this book three? Three? You want to name three?
Garden of Adonis, Lais, Cupid, and...
But go slowly. Garden of Adonis, which is Cupid and Venus's home, and Adonis is the story of Adonis is told there, and she's searching for Cupid all through there. So that's it. It's Canto 6. Okay, yeah. Garden of Adonis.
This Lais, Cupid reference.
Yeah, the Cupid tapestry.
And then I have one more in mind. Let me think.
The Capel Joyous tapestry. The first one we looked at was a tapestry about Venus and Adonis. Canto 12, just to jump ahead, she goes into... what happens... Let's just go ahead. Let's look at Canto 12 so that we're not skimming it in the abstract. So she's in Canto 12, she's in Lucerne's castle, she's taking a look at these tapestries, and then Canto 12, what's the little prome or argument, the little italicized four-line quatrain say? The mask of Cupid and the enchanted chamber are displayed. What's a mask of Cupid?
A play.
It is a play. A mask was a Renaissance art form of basically just a procession of costumed figures. It was also a form of poetry where you described a mask where symbolic figures paraded. So it'd be like, you know, it'd be like a parade today. It'd be like a floats in a parade. A mask was usually pairs of figures would walk on this stage, usually at court. They'd walk out and everybody'd clap, and then the next pair would come forward in their elaborate costumes. And those elaborate costumes and those pairs would always have real symbolic meanings. Yeah, Sam.
Where exactly is this being done in the castle?
Okay. Shall we find out? Okay. Stanza 1. Though when his cheerless night he covered had fair heaven with a universal cloud, and every wight dismayed with darkness sad, in silence and in sleep themselves did shroud, she heard a shrilling trumpet sound aloud, sign of nigh battle or got victory. Not therewith daunted was her courage proud, but rather stirred to cruel enmity, expecting ever when some foe she might descry. So there's Britomart. It's 10 o'clock in the evening. She's been standing in that room from 6 p.m. until 10 p.m. when she hears this trumpet. With that, a hideous storm of wind arose and dreadful thunder, and the world shakes. Yet the bold Britomart was not in dread, though much in move, but steadfast still persevered. All suddenly a stormy whirlwind blew throughout the house that clapped every door. I mean, you can just see this in your scary movie. So the wind comes up, every door claps shut. With that, every door shuts, and at the same time, the iron wicket or gate open flew. I'm in stanza 3. As it with mighty levers had been tore, and forth issued on the ready floor. So just walking out onto the floor of that big room, as if on the ready floor of some theater, that's how masks were performed. They were just performed in court. Say, Queen Elizabeth sitting up there on her royal throne, all her courtiers are standing down below, and like in that movie that you all didn't enjoy, you saw the processions that came out of envoys giving her items. A mask would, instead of envoy, a mask would just come and display it, right? And all the members of the court would stand there and ooh and ah at the elaborate costumes and at the symbolism, because each of the figures would represent something, just like, you know, in Mardi Gras. How many have been to Mardi Gras? How many plan to go to Mardi Gras during spring break while at college? Okay. And you will see that all those parades have themes. You know, that each year it's a different theme. Those parades have themes, and those themes, each float has a theme, fits that theme. Well, that's what a mask is. And the symbolism would generally be just like the symbolism of the Fairy Queen, both allegorical about abstractions, but also political. So there'd always be an elaborate set of political compliments and to Elizabeth and attacks on her enemies in the mask. So here you have this pageant here, and there's 12 maskers that come walking out onto this big room's floor, and each of them is an abstraction. What are they? What are some of them?
Is this like reproach?
What?
Is this like reproach?
Reproach.
Repentance, shame.
Fancy, doubt, right. Danger, fear, hope, dissemblance. I mean, these are allegorical figures of the type that Tolkien was complaining about in his preface. Total, complete abstractions, not living, complex characters. And what's this called? What's this mask called? I've read the title to you already. So
the Mask of Cupid.
Yeah, so this is a trick question. Yes, this is the Mask of Cupid. So all of Canto 11 is devoted to the tapestries of Cupid, and the great majority of Canto 12 is devoted to a mask symbolizing the effects of Cupid. So, you know, and I don't recommend, you know, they're fancy and despair, hope, dissemblance, grief, fury, displeasure, pleasure, all of those things come marching along in the mask of Cupid. And at the end of it come, who comes in the train of it at the end of it?
You're talking about like Cupid on the lion? Or is that what you're talking
about? No, I wasn't. I was talking about the lady.
The girl with the hole in her chest.
Yeah. Stanza 19. After all these, there marched a most fair dame, led of two grisly villains, the one despite the other clepid cruelty by name. That's a little redundant. Clepid meaning named. Named cruelty by name.
He was looking for more
syllables. He certainly was. He certainly was. She doleful lady, like a dreary sprite called by strong charms out of eternal night, had death's own image figured in her face, full of sad signs, fearful to living sight. And you notice what's happened to her, Sam said. She had a hole in her chest and was carrying her heart in a silver basin with her. Who is that?
Amaranth.
That is Amaranth. That is Amaranth. And so these people, this mask of Cupid walks forward, circles the room how many times? You don't even have to have read the poem to know how many times it will circle the room. Because all things happen in threes. So it circles the room and then goes back out the door it came in. And what does Bryn Amart try to do?
Follow those black doors.
Yep. And?
It's locked.
It's locked, can't get in. So what does she resolve to do?
Wait 24 hours for them to come back.
So, you know, this would be, wouldn't be the most thrilling those MMO quest here.
Wait, come back in 24 hours.
Watch. They'd watch, wait for a respawn, which is exactly what she does. She waits for a respawn. And when the respawn occurs, what does she do? Dashes in the door while all the maskers are coming back out again. So every night at 10 p.m. till midnight, the maskers come out and parade poor Amaranth with her heart torn out around the room three times. And Bryn Amart stands over to the side watching it. How come they don't see her?
Yeah. She's hiding behind something.
And she's got a sable cloak. She's got one of those things like Frodo had in book 3 of the Fellowship, you know, the elf cloak. That's what she's got. So it's dark in there, she's got her sable cloak on, and she's standing back in a niche behind a statue watching
it.
What?
It's also in the Silmarillion. Elf grows out her hair, and she has black hair, and makes a cloak out of it.
Very cool.
Yeah, and also weaves and spells into it.
Yeah. Okay, she rushes in, and what does she see inside?
Amaranth is chained to a pillar. And the wizard is like
casting spells at her.
Right.
Essentially. Charms or something.
How is she dressed, Amaranth?
Is she naked?
It'd be stanza 30. How was she dressed when she came out in the mask?
very plainly, I remember it saying that there was no, she didn't have jewelry.
She didn't have jewelry. On stanza 20, she's her breasts all naked as net ivory, without adorn of gold or silver bright. Does that mean that she's nude, or does it mean that she doesn't have any jewelry?
Well, I don't know, though,
because
the last line of that is talking about how
that
her
dyed in sanguine red, her skin all snowy clean. It's not clear to me whether she's naked or not. In myth and in romance, naked women held in by evil wizards or by foul dragons. It's a very common motif. So it's not crystal clear to me whether she's there or not. Though, you know, with closer reading, we could perhaps tell. On 30, she's bound to a pillar like what. Name a few figures in myth bound to pillars or trees.
Prometheus.
Prometheus.
Was it Andromeda?
Andromeda is a good example.
Atlas?
Atlas?
Yeah.
Yeah, but not because of somebody wanting him. Yeah, but that would. So both of her hands are bound, and she's got around her waist, she's got an iron band to the pillar by which she stands, and before her, this vile enchanter weaving his spells. And the knight, she rushes in and draws her sword, and what happens?
All of the images of the mask disappear.
They vanish. Yeah. So what does that tell you about the mask?
It was just an illusion.
What?
I think it was just an illusion.
It was just an illusion.
Which might be another reason why they didn't notice. Maybe another reason why they didn't notice Britomart.
That would be another reason they didn't notice Britomart. It would also be a reason why Amaret could still be alive right now, when previously her heart had been ripped out and put on a silver basin.
Well, there's that too.
There's that too. And, you know, it's your typical illusion that these wizards weave. You know, you never know what you're looking at, reality or. And so the wizard, seeing Britomart come at him with sword raised, does what?
Pulls
out the knife and tries to stab her for real. He's going to get Amaret for real this time, you know, rather than illusion. That's not a very attractive way to love someone, to say, well, if I can't have her, I'm going to kill her. But that's what the villain of the piece does. And then what happens? There's something more. She does, but before that.
Britomart gets wounded?
Yeah.
Again, and
Britomart grabs the knife. And what?
Well, she gets angry again after she gets wounded and beats him down.
So, would you say that she smote him? She smote him.
She's my sister. Incredibly. It says it's like an extreme smite.
It's like
I don't remember exactly where
it is. Right. She gets a critical hit.
Yeah, exactly.
34, you're absolutely right, Amir. So mightily she smote him that to ground he fell half dead. Next stroke him should have slain, had not the lady which by him stood bound sternly unto her called to abstain from doing him to die. That's good action scene here. For else her pain should remedy less, sith none but he which wrought it could the same recur again. Therewith she stayed her hand, loath stayed to be, for life she him envied, and long revenge to see. She really really wanted to take that guy down, but she stays her hand and says, and gets him to undo the charms by which he's bound Hammeret there. The wound to Britomart. Yes, sir.
They always, or the two wounds there have been, both been very, like, mild, like,
superficial.
It's always like, barely got her.
What do you make of that?
I don't know. It like, makes it hard, because we said that she was going to get wounded again, but, like, it's hard to think of her as standing still, because both of her wounds have been this, like, mild thing where she wasn't really fazed by it.
Okay, hold that thought. I want to just underline the word parallel here. We've got parallel Venus and Adonis tapestries, 1 and 12, or 1 and 11. We have parallel wounds, 1 and 12. Now, these are things you should not write on, because I've just talked about them.
Oh, come on.
No. Absolutely not.
What if I observe it myself after this?
Absolutely not, Evan. Thank you for that testimony to the permanence of our class discussion in your memory. That's what I mean by parallel, being large-scale parallels as well as small, imagistic.
No more.
I won't say another parallel. But these are parallels so that you understand that concept the way I used it. I mean, I know you understand the word parallel, but you wanted to know what I meant by parallels. That would be.
How about if I source you?
I would say no.
Jay Clay.
Okay. So let's get back to Sam's insight here. She's wounded twice. Both times, once grazing her in the side, the next time where?
Her chest.
In her chest. So both times in the torso, not on the, you know, not on the arm. You know, and there's plenty of people that get their arms chopped off, and it's specifically that limb that's gone in this play. I mean, in this point, plenty of wounds to other body parts. But here we have wounds. But they're superficial wounds. What else is parallel between these wounds? What's mentioned about them? This is a kind of...
They're bad.
What?
They're bad.
Evan, did you read? They're not bad.
The purple...
Oh, I'm talking about the... I thought we were talking about the one with the hole in the chest.
Ah. No, that would be Amaret. No, we're talking about the wounds to Britomart.
Okay.
They're not bad. Sam has just said they're incredibly superficial. So any other...
Talks about her blood.
Yeah, what?
They both stain her...
They both stain her whiteness. So, you know, when you're doing close analysis of passages, that's the kind of thing you'd want to pick up on. You'd want to make the insight that Sam has made that they're both superficial. Why? We haven't quite expressed that yet. But they both have this red blood on white background image to them. So how would you analyze and put together this motif, this parallel motif?
Well, another thing that's common is that they would happen within a castle.
Yes. Like, yes, exactly. So they both happen not only in a castle, but where else in the castle? Bedroom. Now, this isn't a bedroom exactly, but it's a scene of an attempted seduction. They both happen at the site of an attempted seduction. So thank you for moving us to that point. It's not just inside a castle that's so significant, I think, in this case, but inside, you know, at the very space of seduction. She's wounded and stained.
Maybe because Britomart is like a symbol of chastity.
Yes.
And like indicates like a vulnerable chastity because she gets stained.
Yeah, she is vulnerable to this. It does indicate that she's vulnerable. She's not invulnerable. She's got an enchanted sword, but nobody said enchanted armor. You know, she could be killed.
Could it also be, like, because she is a symbol of chastity and her being wounded is also the acts that may or may not have taken place in that room would be wounding the whole idea of chastity?
Yes, yes, yes. I think you're
and
exactly
not just
on
her as a person. Uh-huh. But
right.
Well, the wounds being non-lethal, not even really that serious, I think is just the point that she's that strong and she's dealing with great evils, but still, she may not be totally corrupt, but there's still some sort of corruption on a small scale everyone.
Yeah, and I like this word corruption.
You were saying earlier that chastity isn't the same thing as virginity, and I think that's kind of the same parallel we see here. As before, we were noting that the wounds that were described before, like the boar and the some other examples, were penetrating versus this one, which was glancing.
Scratching and glancing, to get back to Sam's point. Yeah, the whole class is analyzing this very effectively. I think that the fact that she's vulnerable makes her chastity more precious because she is not she's not immune. She is vulnerable to sexual desire. She can't, but the other thing, in a kind of Christian sense, you cannot go through this world and be untainted. Now, that's a real Christian moral there, that is impossible to be in the world and not be tainted by the world. And so that's why she's not this kind of perfect, Superman. You know, they had to invent kryptonite so that Superman could have a little vulnerability. It's like, she's not that at all. She's a human being, subject to the same temptations and pains, and as a human being. And so she is scraped and is tainted twice, and is all the more to be respected for remaining chaste in spite of that. That's what Spencer's driving at. You almost looked like you wanted to say something. So then the wizard undoes it. Wizard undoes it. What's the castle like after he undoes the spells?
Not as just, it's almost drab. Not as elegant. It's like all the gold disappears and it's no longer clean.
It's on 42. Returning back those goodly rooms which erst she saw so rich and royally arrayed, now vanished utterly, and clean subversed she found, and all their glory quite decayed. That sight of such a change her much dismayed. Perfect, yeah. And the flames are gone too. Those flames never existed. They were just magic illusion. But illusion that could burn if you believed in it. What great opera by Mozart has flames like that? Come on, we got all the musicians in America in this class. Blair, speak to us. Oh no, the hero.
I just play an instrument. I don't do opera.
You might be in the pit sometime.
I play tuba. You're not in the pit.
Nobody's gonna tell me. Nobody's seen.
I just don't spoil it.
The magic flute. The magic flute by Mozart. Which is
the movie?
The one that I knew. There is a movie. There's been four or five movies. What? Phantom of the Opera. Does he go through flames?
Amadeus.
Yeah, it has a little bit from Amadeus being about Mozart. Has a little bit of the magic flute. Well, the magic flute is Mozart's romance. It's a romance opera. And it has this exact walking through fire of illusory flames of fire put there by the wicked magician. Exactly. I thought I would do something for the members from Blair, but it didn't work. Any questions about this, about what we've gone over here? Any questions about what we've gone over? Let's go to the end of Book 3. The end of Book 3 and of Canto 12. Stanzas 43 through 45. She issues forth and finds that Scudamour has taken off because he'd given up hope. After all, she'd gone in there through the fire and been in there for more than 24 hours and hadn't come back. He thought, okay, well, she died trying. Or not she, he doesn't know that. So he's gone away. And let's see, let's read the last lines of the book. But he said, man, when he had long in dread, this is Scudamour, awaited there for Britomart's return, yet saw her not, nor sign of her good speed. His expectation to despair did turn, misdeeming sure that her those flames did burn, and therefore Gan advised with her old squire. What's the squire's name? Glousy, good, or Glaus, or whatever. Who her dear nursling's loss no less did mourn, thence to depart for further aid to inquire, where let them wind at will, whilst here I do respire. Now, if you have the notes to my edition, you will know what I'm about to tell the rest of the class, which is that in the 1590 edition, which was three books long, there was this was the actual end of the poem, and so there was an additional. And do you have it?
It actually says right here.
Yeah, and stanzas 1590 replaced in 1596 with these three. So what he did in 1596, when he published the sixth book version, he took out the old stanzas and replaced them with these three, so that basically he says the story continues, and you'll find out what happened to Scudamour and Glause and Britomart's further adventures in...
sequels.
The sequels. So, you know, this was the second trilogy. And just like, I mean, this is just uncannily like Star Wars, is it not? The original movies are now made into 4, 5, and 6. And the first three came out thereafter. So he had to readjust it.
They intend to do that.
Yeah, he intended all along. Now, I gotta say, he said this poem, which is already the longest in the English language that I know of. It may not be the very longest, but it's the longest I know of. Is 6 books long. His original plan was to be 12 books long, and then he said, if people like the 12, I've got another 12 for a 24 booker in waiting. But I'll wait till I find out whether you like it. Well. Best laid plan. No, people liked it a lot. It's just he didn't live long enough to get past book 6. Because he was writing the beginning of 7, the Mutability Cantos, when he died. And you... Oh, my God, we didn't show.
Didn't Tolkien have
Why didn't you...
I wasn't going to interrupt you. You did such a wonderful job.
You should have interrupted me. Oh, well, we'll preview... The Fairy Queen Online next class.
The Mutability Cantos made him think about it.
The Mutability Cantos, which are the beginning of what people think were the draft of Book 7 to be, appear
in the Fairy Queen Online.
In the Fairy Queen Online, and so you'll have your chance to encounter the Mutability Cantos.
In the text from the Mutability Cantos.
Shortly, online. Get your get going on Weathertop. I will be playing Saturday midday and Sunday midday.
I'm doing it all Thursday on all this Sunday.
And what about tonight? Are you going to do it tonight?
Tonight.
Anybody want to go to Weathertop? Is anybody going to Weathertop? Let's see anybody that plans to go to Weathertop. We tell you we'll escort you.
Me and Jim did it last night.
I think the fair thing to do is put the tides out there. We'll be there.
Why don't you put him on the
Facebook?
No, the freaking internet thing.
Freaking internet.
Well, yeah, whole semester dedicated to Web 2.0. The Web 2.0, and it comes down to the freaking internet thing.
ARPANET?
I'm not going to put that on the syllabus. It's too transient. I don't want something like that.
We don't do transients in our syllabus.
Yeah, we do Facebook for transients.